Mr. Chalmers, Reel 7. We're talking about your time as a liaison officer with the 21st East African Brigade in the Cabor Valley area, moving towards the Chindwin. We talked about the supplies that were dropped. What food supplies would you have?
The tentative conform rations, composite, I think, was the full title. But you got a tin weighing about 25 pounds, which was reckoned to be one day's rations for 8 men, if I remember correctly. I'm not absolutely sure about that. They were basically, if I remember, biscuits and woolly beef and so on. Fairly basic, but adequate, really. If one got jungle rations, you got something which was shaped pretty much like a mess tin, and in fact could be used as a mess tin, you could make tea in it. And it had rather more sophisticated biscuits and a greater variety altogether. But they were obviously, I think, rather more expensive, and we didn't get them very often.
And what about water?
Water, there was, of course, an advertisement on one of the shares of water, but it wasn't all what one would want. But we found that by putting in what was, I suppose, that basically a chloride of lime, you got water which was usable. To say it was, I suppose, technically it was safe and drinkable in that way, but otherwise pretty well, didn't want to drink it unless it was in tea. But if we were lucky and went too near the Japanese, we could usually make tea. And if I remember right, with the children of Ashton, is it me who had some meetings about?
What about things like latrines? I mean, obviously, just in the jungle.
Yes. That was a problem because in the heat, of course, and in mud, it was rather difficult to dig them where one wanted them. We put them outside the bamboo perimeter wherever possible. Sometimes we have something to do very strictly in emergency inside, but on the whole, that was observed. The latrines were outside, and when you move, I suppose, except the Chindwin Valley, there were some of them there for too long. But one then just covered them up. They sometimes tried to do spread a pattern out of the bags. Using smoke as a means of providing high heat. So, I remember once looking at one that we had done and finding that it had become a seething mass of maggots, which was singularly unpleasant. The general plain was rather a smelly area, the genes and so on. And still, of course, death. The Japanese had a lot to be killed. There was the occasional smell of corpses.
Were they not collected in, or could you not find them?
I think it's the times that they hadn't been found, I think. There were occasional patches of snake jungle. We didn't have usually to go through them, but there were ones of times where obviously dying Japanese had managed to crawl in there and hadn't been noticed.
What about health? Now you'd had malaria and you'd had hepatitis. How did your health stand up to jungle conditions overall?
Funnily enough, pretty well, really. I had, when I left Uji, I had I was really feeling pretty fit. I had not, of course, been doing the sort of things that I then had to do, but I found that it stood out pretty well. And really, when we were in Burma, apart from my colleague, the transport officer, had gone off with the typhus, but when we were actually operating there, we had very few cases of sickness, like malaria and so on.
Any health problems? I mean, things like dysentery, jungle sores, any problems with any of those?
Yes, but in a minor way. I think, problems of chronic diarrhea from being down, I suppose, all the time. Jungle sores, yes. They developed. If they developed on your beard line, you were allowed to grow a beard. Mine never quite reached the beard line, and so I was deprived of the chance of officially finding what
Well, how were they treated, or was there any treatment for them?
I don't remember really where was it. It was one. They, I suppose I was quite lucky they didn't become too much of a menace, an awkwardness rather than a great menace. And feet, of course, it was always very difficult to prevent feet getting rather, I suppose, quite a kind of foot rot, which was unpleasant again, but
now, what would a typical day's routine be like for you in this period in the Kabul Valley as orderly officer, really? I mean, a typical day is difficult to define, but what sort of things would you do in a normal day?
Well, in the normal day, of course, one stood to before dawn, and within the stretch, we apart from our families round about, we all had stint trenches, very often double made by, I suppose, a trench to the thing, the actual space we had.
How deep?
Deep enough to be able to cover yourself completely, I suppose, to get. So
not standing, though, I mean, lying there.
Yeah, if you were standing up, you would be able to see out from them, but if there's any risk, you could, in fact, get your head below the level of the slip trench. And then, after that, getting fed, check the guards, of course.
These are of your perimeter, your defence platoon.
Yes, yes. The orderlies and so on. Everybody more or less marked in there, I think. One would have to be ready to organise the collection of food and so on from the the drops in the Dakota. And incidentally, I might have mentioned that heavy things like food for mules and so on would be dropped without parachutes. And in fact, this became this was a fatal hazard in one or two cases. If you had people in the I remember one case of one guy who had been on a stretcher and got killed by, I suppose, 100 weight of oats or something like that. They were done inside three concentric sacks, so that they didn't, in fact, they usually remained whole, but they were a great danger. You could see them coming, but of course, if you were on a stretcher, say, you couldn't do anything about it.
So the collection, how would you know where they were? You just see where they were dropping, and then
we usually put out colored markers so that the Dakotas would know where we wanted the land. They were actually one thing they could. Most of them were able to calculate where a country with rations attached would land. And usually they would take within 200 yards at least, or at most, of where we wanted them. But of course, it was a matter then of organizing the collection, and if possible, of course, working out which way and so on.
So you'd go out with your mules and some askaris to fetch them?
Maybe with askari then, yes. They were usually in loads that could be carried by a very tough askari. No, the mules only came into action when you were moving from A to B.
Now, what next then? Typically, or perhaps only.
Yes. It was a typical day.
So what other duties might you have to do then, on a day, you know? If the camp was moving, you'd presume.
If the camp was moving, then it was a matter of making sure that everyone was in line and they were all going the right direction, that we were looking after the mules and so on. And then, if we were moving from A to B, I would probably have to go on and to where the camp would be, and roughly lay out where places things would go, how it could be defended, and so on. Yes, and I think one of the two occasions that it meant that brigade headquarters was in fact the leading troop. It's a very odd situation. You actually could claim that the Japanese had moved in eventually if there hadn't been. There was no sort of direct line that didn't bother us because we were getting our rations from the air. But if we were trying to go by land to another unit, it could be difficult. Otherwise, well, whenever the brigade arrived at a place, of course, it functioned as usual. Again, things like we had mail would be dropped on us, and very often the mail from the brigade would come to brigade headquarters, and that would be a job that naturally the officer would have to do.
So that would be dropped with everything else?
Yes.
And you'd have to sort it out and get it to the right people?
Yes. Usually bring down them. We had a fairly good field telephone system, and I'd bring down the battalions and say, could you please send a document to get students? And that was a fair amount of quite useful organisation there. And I really can't quite remember the exact things, but I know that one was busy all the time, and by and large, quite happy with it.
Did you get on well with the other officers of the staff?
Yes.
Any particular friends?
the Jewish was a staff captain then, Henry Mason, in particular, he was quite poetic. I remember we quote poetry to each other as a tension in the morning, but otherwise the Arvonians,
what was McNab like as a boss, as a commanding officer? What
the brigadier was excellent. He realised that loading up the brigade on mules and so on was a job that couldn't actually be done to a timetable, and he was completely understanding about this. He was aware of the irascibility of the man who was in charge of the mule company, and I think on occasions I got the job of locating the Judah Blooms, the mule man. He'd a very good eye for working out what was possible and what could be expected, and being very understanding of it. He was very well liked by everyone. I think he even had spoke good Jinyan Jung Swahili, and the Askari knew that he was the boss, and a general respect from everyone.
Now, did you have much of a liaison role at this time with your battalion?
No, I didn't, really. Effectively, I was a liaison officer in paper. My job was practically entirely inside brigade headquarters.
Now, what was going on with the Japanese? I mean, do you see, and what were the battalions in action during this point? And were they in action as frontline troops, or was it just sort of they was more reserve?
The battalions were actual, they were the spearhead troops. The idea had been that African troops would be able to cope with heat. So they took East Africans, mainly just from the plain dwellers, and imported them into jungle. They, in fact, adapted remarkably well, but they were, in fact, the spearhead of the 14th Army, I suppose.
Then did you see much of this action? I understand from your thing, you didn't, as a brigade headquarters, you'd naturally be mostly behind the line, but what do you know of the fighting, that as it affected you?
Well, when we went over this brigade headquarters, it was because the 4th AER had been held up by a very strong Japanese position.
Now, is this over the Kabor or over the Chinwin? I do get a bit mixed up.
It was between the Kabor and the Chinwin, yes.
And where was this hold up at?
Well, I think this was officially at Leik Hill, L-E-I-K Hill.
And L-E-I-K.
L-E-I-K, yes. And soon after, there was a little place on the map, Chinwagali. I think it had been a village, but there was nothing left of that. And when we got there, we were very near this Leik Hill, and the Japanese were dug in such places and sort of points on the top of the hill. They got up high bombers that they were able to get assistance from the Air Force. They bombed this area and fairly drastically, quite near the bombing, and I was much impressed by what it must have been another 100 yards ahead where the chaps were. And that didn't quite dislodge them, although, in fact, I think in that particular place they did move overnight. Then, otherwise, the 4th KR put in an attack. And we were able to feel of that.
So that you captured Like Hill, or yes, the brigade did?
The brigade did, yes. And I remember a group of them, there were still one or two chap casualties. I remember one had really fallen, he lay back and he had a gold tooth. And it's one of those silly little things that one remembers. The sunlight was shining on the gold tooth. And it just somehow made it even more macabre than it might have been.
Was he dead or wounded?
Dead, yes. In fact, I don't remember many Japanese wounded. They tended either to be alive or dead. They were quite likely to kill themselves.
How then, at this point, did you feel about the Japanese before you met any, so to speak? I mean,
yes, it's difficult to say, really. I mean, they were the enemy, and at this time, but I suppose one remembered things that we felt, I suppose, that it'd been a rather treacherous attack in the Purple Heart and so on. One didn't feel very kind to do it. On the other hand, one would have felt certainly as hostile to the Nazis, and probably more so. And there were people who with a strange language, usually we thought of them as being rather small. I suppose one just had the general feeling that that's the enemy, and they were a nuisance. They'd come round at night banging on bamboo and so on, trying to wake us up.
Did they ever attack your compound at all? Overnight?
No. They were usually one or two coming rather. Their intention was for us to give away our positions, I think. You see, if we fired at them, they would notice where the flash was, and that would give them a point to perhaps attack our mortars. There was a people did try to personally to attach Mills grenades with bits of string along to cover areas where they might have walked. I don't remember that actually working very well.
So they'd infiltrate the
exactly, yes. And again, our telephone lines might get cut. And I seem to remember hearing some, "Give me platoon commander, give me platoon commander." And very obviously, they can't have been able to cut in on the line.
Would they shoot at your? I mean, if they found you where you are, you said they tried to establish a position. If they did fire, would they fire at you?
They would have, but in fact, they didn't. They were inside our area. We were fairly.
Did you come under fire at all during this period from either artillery or mortar or? Or snipers?
Later on, we did come under artillery fire.
But at this stage, not?
At this stage, I don't remember that.
So although you were at the front, the brigade headquarters were quite just behind the front line, that you were just lucky, you just didn't come under fire at that stage.
I think that would be the case, yes. And in fact, the Japanese were then on more of a defensive area. Defensifying, and they were holding their strong points, which had to be attacked by the battalions. And the other ones would be really, I suppose, trying to weaken the attacking force. But I think they knew by now that they were not going to move forward. Their attack on Kohima and Imphal had completely failed, and it was really a matter of protect. think they had brought up some fresh troops to cover the retreat of the rest who were in a pretty bad mood.
Now, what happened next then? You were moving towards the Chindwin.
Yes. Well, we were near, I think, Malaik was the big sort of place on the map that had been from the Chindwin. I think it was Malaik.
How would you spell that?
M-O-W-L-A-I-K. Yes. It's more common than Malaik, I think. And one of our battalions, which was I think the 5th KR, which was I think it was attached to us for the time being, had actually got across the Chindwin.
At Malaik?
North of Malaik. I can't quite remember.
If we said near Malaik, that would be.
Yes. A bit further upriver from there. And I remember they were coming back to rejoin the division. Two turns, of course, of being on duty. I remember having to work out my situations of where secrecy was useful, but not. Incidentally, I should have mentioned we had a cipher unit attached to us, ciphers and signals at the gate.
Okay, I'll come back to that. So, what were you doing when the 4th KR came back?
Well,
the
5th.
5th, sorry.
I had to indicate to the by this. I can't remember the technical name for it, but I had to work out what the map reference would be in this code. I felt it was rather a responsibility to let them know which bit of the Chindwin they had to cross in code. But it worked. They got back all right. But I was slightly worried about that.
And what was the next stage? What happened next? When would you cross?
We were, I think, a little bit downriver from Malaik. The idea was that the two battalions would cross, minus my own battalion, the 1st NLR, which would continue on the west bank of the Chindwin. Our aim was to cross the river and cut down to to cut the road to Mandalay. Yes. Duty at the headquarters with the 2nd and 4th KR was to about 2 or 3 miles away from the Chindwin initially, and then to proceed south to cut the road from the Kalena on the Chindwin onto Mandalay. By the time we had cut the road, it was then possible for the engineers to build a bailey bridge by floating sections down the Chindwin, and that was then used for the to move through on the Mandalay.
So they passed through you?
Yes, yes.
So did you hold the bridgehead for them, in a sense?
Technically, yes. Yes, we were there, and I think by then there were no Japanese between us and the Chindwin.